him.
You want it up?
Yeah, this one. Thank you.
All the way?
All the way. And open an informational meeting on access to clinical trials. Right?
Yes.
I still don't know why.
That's all right.
What that does.
It's official movement through the committee.
Some historian will someday tell me.
Parliamentarian.
Well, parliamentarian just tells me when I do it, not why I do it. I'd like to know why I do it. Okay, we have some witnesses.
Yes, we do.
Should we make
a panel?
Should we do something?
Okay, we have Christine McDonald.
We have majority.
Brenda Eichenberger. Brenda Eichenberger. Brandon Hayes-Layton. Is that it?
Yep.
Let's go. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you do have some written customers.
I'll go ahead and start. Thank you so much. Please. For letting us bring our concerns to you. It's an honor to be before you. I'll introduce myself. I'm Brenda Eichelberger. I am an instructor at Portland State University. I am also a clinical trials patient up at OHSU, and I am a fifth-generation Oregonian. The reason I bring that up is because my ancestors walked the Oregon Trail, and my great-great-grandfather was actually a state senator here in the 1860s. He unfortunately contracted smallpox while he was here at the legislature and brought it home to the farm and the family. There was an epidemic going at that time. He had the opportunity. There was a farmhand that came through and explained to my great-great-grandmother that if she took the risk of cutting all of the children's arms and the udder of a cow that had had smallpox.
Cowpox.
Yeah. Cowpox, yeah. And mixed that together, that it would save the children. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it did not save my grandfather nor the baby, but it did save the rest of the family. It's kind of pioneer spirit that I think we have here in Oregon, and that's the kind of risk that we need to take at times to make a difference when we're facing epidemics and problems and insurmountable crises. I'm facing a personal one myself right now in that I have cancer. I have CLL. It's a terminal, untreatable. There's no cure. They can make you more comfortable. They can't explain how to increase overall survival rate. But there are a lot of promising clinical trials. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my diagnosis and then my challenge in getting into the clinical trial, and then a friend of mine that did not have such good fortune. So myself, November of 2005, I had a tickle in my throat one Monday night. I woke up the next day, my glands were huge. I was unable to almost breathe. It took them a while to diagnose it, but as soon as they did, I did have an opportunity to go into a clinical trial, except I had to be approved by my insurance company. So I was approved by my insurance company when I called them. Then, unfortunately, the trial site said...
Just a moment. Did anybody else shut off their pagers or phones? Appreciate that. Excuse me. Go ahead, please.
So then what happened was the trial site was told I was not approved, so I could not get into the trial. It was a competitive fill trial, which meant there was 9 sites throughout the United States with 70 openings. So it was mandatory that I get in very quickly. We went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until finally I had to agree to sign personal payment for standard routine care, which is care that would be covered for me every 3 months with my insurance because I need my blood monitored to see my progression. My insurance company said they would, they would not, they would, they would not. And until I said, you know, whatever, the money isn't the issue, I will sign it. Just let's do this. Let's get the biopsy. I will. So what happened was I got that signed off, and fortunately I was able to be in the clinical trial. I am in the clinical trial at this point, and it's potentially a designer vaccine that will go in and retrain my immune system to be able to eradicate the cancer. I'm sure you've heard about the gene splicing, and it gets very detailed, but an exciting proposition, and I was thrilled to be able to get in. Unfortunately, I have talked to a lot of other people, and it ends up being a difficult situation for many. This is a story of a friend of mine, Judith. She was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer last July, so starting treatment quickly was a priority. Her primary care doctor referred her to OHSU, but there were no open clinical trials at OHSU. She then got referred to Providence. Providence had a trial for her where they were eager. It was available. She was all qualified. But then Aetna was her insurance company, and it went back and forth and back and forth, back and forth, until she had signs of bone pain. So they had to go ahead and put her into the radiation treatment instead of on the chemo, which was the direct course that her doctor recommended, but her insurance put it into the position where it had progressed too far for her to be able to go into the clinical trial, and she missed that boat. She is at this time still doing the radiation and not doing the chemo therapy that would have probably been the best course for her disease. So what I find is that when we look at things like smallpox, tuberculosis, polio, we have cured all of these diseases in the past, and we do it with a pioneer spirit. We do it with cooperation. We do it with harmony. We do it with supporting those patients willing to take a risk, to take the different avenues, and to listen to the people that have the ideas. And that is something I would like to see resolved. 24 states have already done this in the nation, and we also have Medicare ruling that states this is the way that we should be handling clinical trials. I'm concerned that Oregon is becoming a second-class state. I'm concerned that we're letting insurance companies, not through their own vindictiveness, but mainly through inefficiencies, not getting the best care for our citizens. So I'm looking for hope that we're going to be able to correct this pretty easily, and looking for a bill to come before you for increased access to clinical trials this year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Chris McDonald.
We'll take the whole panel and then we'll open for questions. Is that the best?
Sorry. Time?
Yes, okay, go ahead. No, please go ahead.
I'm Chris McDonald. I'm the executive director of Susan G. Komen for the Cure in Oregon and Southwest Washington. As many of you may be aware, Susan G. Komen for the Cure is a global organization that was started 25 years ago on a promise of a sister to a younger sister who was diagnosed with breast cancer. In 25 years, we have become the largest private funder of breast cancer research in the world, and have an army of activists and survivors fighting to end breast cancer forever. I'm here to represent a very large organization that places high importance on clinical trials. We know that a lot of the research that has been done, the translational research from bench to bedside, is a result of the clinical trials. And I'm just here to say that Komen on a national level has seen a great importance in this. As to demonstrate that, this year, Komen is funding our all-time high of $100 million in 2008 for breast cancer research. That's up 22% over last year. Of that $100 million number, $23.4 million is directed to clinical research. So it is an importance, and we know this category will grow. So I'm just basically here to say Komen as an organization supports this, and we see it important to guarantee access and ensure this for Oregonians, as 24 other states have as well. I also want to say one thing about Komen and our work to recruit underserved populations into clinical trials. That's also a priority for our organization as well.
I'm Dr. Brandon Hayes-Latin. I'm a medical oncologist and bone marrow transplant physician at OHSU. I'm also the medical director of adolescent and young adult oncology there, and a member of the Cancer Institute. I'm also a testicular cancer survivor, and while I didn't participate myself in a clinical trial, it was out of the fortune of the patients who came before me, who, through careful clinical trials, demonstrated that I could actually forego some of what used to be standard chemotherapy and launch into a surveillance program, and was lucky enough not to need additional therapy. So I've benefited from clinical trials myself. I wanted to talk a little bit about how we view the critical importance of clinical trials. Clinical trials are important in that they are the way we advance medical care, whether it's diagnostic tools, treatment tools, preventive tools. The way we know what works and what doesn't work, what is safe and what is effective, is through cancer clinical trials. Clinical trials often, as you heard in Brenda's story, are a really important therapeutic option for patients to have access to the very latest care by experts. But in addition, it's the way we advance cancer survival rates. At OHSU, we've had the fortune of success in clinical trials. Dr. Brian Druker, who is our Cancer Institute Director, led a program investigating a compound, a pill, to treat a particular type of leukemia called CML. And through careful and controlled clinical trials, demonstrated it was safe, then demonstrated it was highly effective, and in fact has changed the world in the treatment of that leukemia from a standard of care of bone marrow transplant to a standard of care of swallowing a pill twice a day. We also have evidence that clinical trials impact cancer survival rates. As I mentioned, I direct an adolescent and young adult program which has received attention from the National Cancer Institute as a disparity area, in that cancer survival rates for children has increased dramatically since the 1970s. Today, the five-year survival rate for a child is about 85%. But if you look at older teens and young adults, there's actually been no change in five-year cancer survival rates since the 70s. If you correlate that with clinical trial participation, you find that about 60 to 70% of children in the United States receive their treatment as part of a cancer clinical trial, whereas less than 5% of adults do. So we feel very strongly that the way we're going to impact cancer survival rates is through clinical trials. As you've heard, patients often have difficulty accessing clinical trials, and one of the barriers to that is often insurance denial of the routine care costs. And just to describe what routine care costs are, if a patient comes to me with lymphoma and I prescribe a drug chemotherapy regimen and a series of monitoring CAT scans, that's routine standard of care, the administration of the chemotherapy and the monitoring of toxicity. If the same patient comes to me and there's a trial adding a fifth drug to that regimen and measuring whether the addition of that fifth drug is safe and effective, those trials come with sponsors. So a pharmaceutical company would reimburse, or would actually provide the medication and reimburse for any additional scans or monitoring done on the trial. So that really, from a payer's perspective, it becomes a cost-neutral thing. The routine care costs, or the standard care that any cancer patient would be getting during their treatment, the access is not geared towards that additional cost associated with the investigational therapy. That's part of what's reviewed in the institutional review board before a trial is approved. However, because most policies list experimental or investigational therapy as an exclusion, that leads to lots of confusion and lots of rounds of appeals, both for patients, for providers, and for insurance companies to manage. And as a consequence of that, we think that's a major barrier to enrolling patients in clinical trials. We're not the only ones who think this. As you heard, there are 20 states who have legislation in place clarifying the coverage of routine care costs in clinical trials. There are four other states with special agreements. And actually, the model for this has been Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which addressed this issue in the year 2000 and established a policy for routine care cost coverage. This was just readdressed last July through October and reaffirmed in October of this year as an important measure. Finally, as a representative of the OHSU Cancer Institute, I think it's important for me to describe not just how cancer clinical trials are important for cancer patients and for improving survival rates, but for our program to survive. That the way that we exist to perform cancer clinical trials. That if we have difficulty enrolling patients in clinical trials, then that means we have difficulty gaining the interest of pharmaceutical companies or other investigators wishing to launch clinical trials. We have to compete with other cancer institutes in states that have this sort of legislation. It also means that we have difficulty just in recruiting the kinds of experts that we need to treat cancer patients and design cancer trials. Because if they know coming to Oregon is going to lead to difficulty in accruing patients, they may look other places. So that's what I wish to let you know, and I guess at this point we'd be happy to take any questions about this issue.
Good. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much to all of you for being here. I want to try to get my hands around where the impediments are, and I got a sense, especially from you, Dr. Hayes-Latin, that it's primarily in the insurance exclusions, but I'm not quite sure of that. Is there some other impediment that's restricting the number of people you can accept, or is it just primarily the insurance issue that leads to the lag in time between people who want to get in and can eventually get in?
We think this is a major barrier, which is why we're focused on it. There are other barriers to clinical trial participation, like transportation to a facility that has clinical trials open. But the issue quite often is one that when this line of treatment is proposed as part of a clinical trial, it is therefore assumed to be investigational or experimental therapy, and most carriers have that as an exclusion criteria. In our experience, it's actually quite variable. Many insurance carriers fully intend and actually have language saying that they will and do cover routine care costs. It's often in the administration or the interpretation of that requires multiple appeals, requires extra effort on the patient's part, extra effort on the cancer center's part, actually extra effort on the insurance company's part to process those appeals, and oftentimes, as you heard, that those appeals and that delay loses the window for clinical trial participation.
Thank you.
Representative Broom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, each of you, for your testimony. Thank you for your sharing your very special story. And, Doctor, thank you for mentioning that you're a testicular cancer survivor. So am I. I wanted to ask you about two points. One, you addressed, but my question in broad terms is competitive disadvantage. What sort of competitive disadvantage is this specifically put OHSU in? You mentioned pharmaceutical studies. What about NIH? Can you quantify that to a degree or measure it? You mentioned other states, but how big of an impediment is it right now?
Well, I don't have numbers to quantify, but yes, you're right. There's a broad range of clinical trials. And in fact, we describe cancer clinical trials, but this same issue happens across all diseases. Trials for heart disease and diabetes, et cetera, run into this exact issue. So it's difficult for me to exactly quantify, but I think it's huge. And you're right, it's not just pharmaceutical companies. It's certainly National Cancer Institute and other NIH-sponsored agency studies. There's also a range of what clinical trials are. There are phase one clinical trials, which are more safety trials, phase two and three, which are more efficacy trials, and even phase four trials, which are long-term follow-up trials. So it's a broad range.
Okay, but it's a very, I mean, your point is, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but a fairly compelling argument that this is a competitive disadvantage to specifically at OHSU across a broad spectrum of medical issues.
Right, I mean, to attract the source of investigators that have a proven track record who come with NIH funding really requires the opportunity to place patients on clinical trials. And I think without having this sort of protection, when you're looking at 24 other states that do, it puts us at a competitive disadvantage.
Right. Second question I would have, it was mentioned there were 24 states that have enacted some sort of legislation, 20 with, you know, quote unquote a mandate, 4 with a special agreement. Can you help me understand what a special agreement is?
You know,
because I'm sitting here brainstorming, and part of the thing, you know, I mean, we can all talk about mandates, and we all sort of have our own, you know, fears or apprehensions about what a mandate may mean, but there seems to me there might be a role for the state, and I don't want to put the cart too far in front of the horse, but there might be a role for the state to serve as some sort of a bridge, almost a backstop guarantee. I'm wondering if that's what these special agreements are.
Yeah, it's really a little bit outside of my area of expertise. I haven't reviewed them myself. The standard that we have embraced is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. It's a very simple and straightforward description of what routine care costs are and what the issues around coverage is. And again, it's a process that was just reviewed just within the last calendar year. So that's been the benchmark that we've looked to.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
Could I add a quick comment?
Absolutely.
I'm working just on the building of coalition, and I have been speaking with quite a few people. The MS Society is very interested in supporting us in any way. They have a designer vaccine that's very similar to what I'm going through. We have Dr. Nichols up at Providence, who's heavily involved with us and our team. We have the Lymphoma Society, which is another cancer society, but we've talked the Lupus Society, the Arthritis Foundation, diabetes. There's a lot of people who are saying, let me know what letters to write, what can we do? And we said, well, we're in informational, we're putting things out. But you are going to see a very large coalition. This is a big concern, and there are everyone I've talked to has just been, let me know what we can do. This is a problem. We want to clear this up. It looks like we'll be on board. We're forwarding it to our national office to get approval. So very exciting that is happening, and quickly.
And Mr. Chair, can I throw back another question out there? I know I've sort of passed my time, but I'm sorry.
Representative Maurer yields to you.
Well, I'm sure he doesn't, but I'll take it. Yeah, and once again, maybe this panel is not the right panel to ask the specific questions. Once again, it's a quantitative question. How many folks, or what percentage of folks, that would qualify for these clinical trials are being turned away or ultimately rejected? I mean, are we talking 5%, 25%, 50%? I don't have a gauge of what that spectrum is.
So in the state of California, the California is the state that enacted legislation around this care cost question. They did a survey before legislation and found that the odds of a patient with non-government insurance, in other words, that the existing Medicare rule did not apply to, the odds of getting on a clinical trial were one-third that of patients with government insurance. That survey was repeated 2 years ago after the passage of this law, and they found that there was no difference. And they actually surveyed and asked, was payment for routine care costs a factor in, a barrier in your participation, and not a single patient recorded that as a factor.
So two out of three then are being rejected, at least in California, or had been.
Or perceived. Okay. The problem is, you've been kicked and you've been told, I mean, if you've gone through a diagnosis and then to have someone pushing you around again, it's really easy to give up. It's just easy to say, whatever. And so I think the perception and the delay and the frustration and confusion ends up being magnified when you're at a dip.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My questions are, first off, how many people in the state of Oregon are going through clinical trials, not just in your organization, but statewide? I don't necessarily expect you to be able to answer that, but that clearly is a question. What?
I expect we could put an approximate number in there. I'm going to testify in a moment, too.
Okay.
I think it is possible to come up with a magnitude.
Outside of the situations here, you know, on television, because I don't watch much television at home, I do here because I have a couple of extra hours at night, and you see ads for they're looking for participants in clinical trials here in Salem. And there's a local medical clinic, and I'm not sure what the name of it is, and I don't want to advertise. Down in Southern Oregon, we have advertisements on the television for Medford Medical Clinic, looking for participants. In our office, we get requests all the time for looking for patients that meet certain criteria to apply for clinical trials. And this is a very, very fundamental question that we're asking here in all the United States about healthcare reform and what we are doing. Pharmaceutical costs are just, we're doing everything we can to address high cost of pharmaceutical. And what are some of the reasons that we have high costs? Some of the reasons are because we are very aggressive in our research. And so companies can't do research if they don't have income from selling drugs, but yet we try to drive the price of drugs down in the number of vehicles. There's going to be a point where we have to make some very fundamental moral decisions about what we do in addressing clinical trials.
Well, and I agree, but with the standard care issue, which is what we're addressing, it is cost neutral. It will actually save insurance companies and save pharmaceuticals and save doctors' office and save people's lives. It's something that is a confusion, unclear. I'm a very organized college instructor, and the problem with this system is that you have one person telling you one thing, and then it has to be verified by another, and they're all making $10 an hour. And I ended up finally calling my lawyer and having to record phone conversations because it depended who answered the telephone. So with the standard care issue that we're talking about with this clinical trials, we've looked into the fact that it is cost neutral. It should increase efficiencies, save money all the way around. It's unfortunate language, and I think the reason that we have it kind of patchworked in 24 states, and I'm going ahead of Brandon here, but just off of my own, they're trying to solve a problem, and really federally they're trying to get it settled, and so that's why we're looking at the federal language to try and get one kind of one size fits all instead of a bunch of little pieces put together. Does that answer your question at all?
It does. No, okay. I appreciate you just expanded my remarks, and that's great. Another issue is that if this body in 2009 makes a decision to add this to our statute, it only affects a small percentage of the insured in the state of Oregon. We do not control large group insurance. Those are outside our purview. So if you're looking for us to solve all of the problems, we only, because of federal law, we can only control a certain, sector of the insurance population. I'm really looking forward to the conversation because I think it brings up a lot of interesting issues. I'm not sure. I'm very interested in the insurance company. Why, if you're going to pay for it, why haven't they figured out the administrative trail on this so that, that you're not getting the bounce around? We get it every day, but I just expect it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick, welcome to this committee.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify, sir. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I really do welcome an opportunity to testify on this issue because I think it's a critical issue, and because I think in my experience I have some things to share with the committee that might be useful in this deliberation. I think, as many of you know, for 32 years I was Director of Research for Kaiser Permanente in Portland, headed the Center for Health Research, and was Vice President of Research for Kaiser Foundation Hospitals through about 20 years of that period. And I had a great deal of experience dealing with this problem, with this issue, inside a closed system. At the Center for Health Research, we were typically at any one time doing 12 or 15 different clinical trial projects through most of that time, of a variety of kinds. And the first thing to remember is there are different kinds of clinical trials. much of what Representative Maurer was talking about before, the advertising for a clinical trial, would be clinical trials that were being done by drug companies in order to bring their product to market. There needed to be, as a part of the FDA approval, a relatively large number, depending on the drug, of trials of drug X, the drug they wanted to bring to market, against sometimes a placebo, but more frequently a drug that was the commonly used drug in that area. So you have one form of diuretic, and now you want to try and get a different form to market, and that requires a set of clinical trials dealing both with efficacy and to a greater sense effectiveness nowadays. And in those trials, it was really common to expect the drug companies to provide all the cost of medical care, not only the usual cost, but all the cost of medical care as a part of being a part of that trial. Not always, but usually, because it was specifically in the drug company's best interest, leading to a patent, leading to the ability to market a drug. There are trials that are the kind we were talking about here that I want to get treatment. I looked, for example, for clinical trials when I started treatment on lymphoma, and ended up not being able to do a clinical trial for one reason or another. So an expert who was doing a clinical trial sort of guided me in a direction, but it was purely unknown. It was a matter of three potential treatments, treatment A, treatment B, treatment C, flip a coin. And the decision was made not on the basis of knowledge of that, but on the basis of, a variety of things. I think I selected correctly, but that's not the point. But usually, and it was really true in Kaiser Permanente, that the oncologist wanted to find a clinical trial because the clinical trial offered a choice of the existing best therapy and the one that was hypothesized to be an improvement on the existing best therapy. A very narrow question. This drug regime of three drugs versus a drug regime of those three drugs plus a fourth drug, for which there was some evidence that that fourth drug would potentiate the effect of the other three. And if I wanted to have access to that fourth drug, or potential access, the only way that I could get that access, or my oncologist could get that access, was by enrolling me in one of the national clinical trials that would offer me A or B, A being what I would get anyway, and B being what might be better. And that is a flip of the coin, and it's a legitimate flip of the coin. And those kind of trials are what, inch by inch, has advanced cancer therapy enormously. Then there's the fourth kind of clinical trial that's a sort of a clinical trial, but an observational trial. For example, I'm a subject in the Mr. Oz project at OHSU, which is a study of aging, a set of factors in aging men around bone density, prostate cancer, sleep, and a variety of other things. And in that case, you come in every 5 years and take this whole battery of tests, including densitometries, and in this case, they came out and wired you up into sleep stuff, and there was all sorts of things. And it was an observational trial. It was NIH paid for, and it was the intention of that trial. All the services in that trial were essentially paid for by the NIH grant or by a grant of some sort. Sometimes drug companies join with NIH in that kind of a trial. It depends on it, but it's a pure observational trial. The subject is doing it not for much in the way of their benefit, but basically doing it for science. Then there are the fourth kind of trial, which was a very common trial a while ago, which is, should we treat this or not? A common trial of that was, I was one of the original investigators in the systolic hypertension in the elderly project, which was a project that asked the question, should you treat isolated systolic hypertension in the elderly? Systolic hypertension is the higher number, and there was a very common phenomenon that higher number got higher as people aged, and there was a hypothesis in the clinical literature that was a natural part of aging, and as the brain, as the vessels in the brain became hardened, the heart had to push harder to get blood to the brain and to other parts of the body. Otherwise, so the idea was that's natural aging. You don't treat that. There were cardiologists and others who had this the sense that high blood pressure is usually bad, whatever it is. And we started from scratch enrolling people in treatment versus placebo. And in that case, the question is, should you treat this drug? This was paid for by NIH, and the basic costs of the trial, not all the costs, but the basic costs were covered by an NIH grant, partly financed by a drug company in this case. And we did eventually find out that we would reduce heart attacks and strokes in an elderly population by 25% by treating as opposed to not treating. Now, all four of these trials bring a different consideration to the question of insurance. And in Kaiser, and I'm not speaking for Kaiser now, let me make clear, I retired from Kaiser in 1995. Life might be very different, although the research center is even bigger than it was when I was there. At that time, the principle was, if it was routine care, it was paid by Kaiser, but if it was special care related to the trial, it was paid for by the sponsor of the trial, or by Kaiser's charitable funds, which they were willing to put in explicitly in order to do certain trials. Now, this whole question of why is there an experimental exclusion in most health insurance companies, and the answer to that is really pretty clear. I have treatment for a disease in Portland, and I can get it at Kaiser, or I could get it at the university. But at the University of Idaho Medical School, there's this special treatment that they're working on that might be the right thing, but it costs $100,000 for that treatment. And the treatment has not yet been proven, and the insurance companies want to protect themselves against paying for an unproven therapy simply because I, as a patient, decide I want to go to Idaho and get this therapy. We heard cases of at the early days of the Oregon Health Plan about certain kinds of transplants that were experimental that hadn't been proven yet to be efficacious or effective. And the protection is to try and deal with the insurance companies being forced into paying for a therapy that's not standard therapy for the community. And sometimes that's a big problem because sometimes it turns out that is the best therapy. And sometimes in hopeless cases, I, as a patient, I don't give a damn whether it's the best therapy. What I have is failing me now, and here's the hope, and I want to go get that other therapy, even though it's not going to be covered by insurance, because I don't really have any other decent options, and it's a very difficult decision. But there's also a difficult problem, and one we'll have to be careful as we address this in the next session, as I expect we're going to, in really determining what is usual care costs. I had an offhand comment from my oncologist the last time I was there saying at that visit, well, I'm not going to bother to do a bone marrow transplant. If you want to study, I would do a bone marrow transplant because I want to be seeing how things are going along the way. But in terms of clinical care, as long as you're feeling well, as long as your scan looks all right, I won't do that bone marrow biopsy at that point. We'll just do X and Y. Now, if I were in a trial, even in Kaiser, I think there would have been an argument that that was routine care, when in fact it really wasn't routine care. So there, even an insurance company trying to do the right thing to pay, I'm a patient with a particular disease, I need to have my blood pressure checked every month, I'll pay for that blood pressure check every month, I need to have an electrocardiogram every 6 months because of my disease, they'll pay for that. But if the study wants an electrocardiogram every month because they want to have finer detail, then the sponsor ought to be paying for 5 out of 6 of those electrocardiograms. I can guarantee you that's a really tough determination to make. And as a corporate officer in charge of research, I was forced, even in an organization that absolutely wanted to pay for the routine costs, for me to defend what I was trying to charge to the insurance company as opposed to the grant on the basis of what's really a research charge. I think it is really urgent. And you asked how many people might be in clinical trials in this state, I would guess the number is somewhere between 10 and 50,000. It's not a trivial number. And sometimes we had more than 1,000 people in clinical trials at the same time at Kaiser, maybe even more, taking care of, in that case, about 25% of the population. Sometimes we had less, but there is a very large number of people in clinical trials, and there are a very large number of people who are not in them whose best interest would, in fact, to be a part of those clinical trials. So let me stop there. I just wanted to put this on the record. And
yes, question?
Please.
Clinical trials are not cheap. If you'd like to have a therapy and you can't afford it, you'd like to have the therapy but have somebody else pay for it. If the university...
Absolutely, I would.
Absolutely. If the university wants to do that as part of their research... Certainly, they have the right to do that. If pharmaceutical companies or other companies that are involved in the industry want to fund it, they certainly have the right to do that. If the state decides as a body that we want to do that and use taxpayer dollars to do that, we have the right to do that. And the taxpayers, if they become unhappy with that, can vote us out. But for... Do you see a problem with having the state say to a profit-making organization, an insurance company, you shall cover this, and even though it raises premiums, and even though it may affect your ability to make money, we think it's a good idea, and therefore we are going to order you, mandate that you do this. Does that, do you have any problem with that?
Well, I think it's a part of the sort of question of what's a contract. If I join Regents, say, and they agree as a part of that contract that they're going to pay for medical care under a set of conditions, I would think we as a state have some interest in enforcing that contract to assure that I'm not excluded from that agreement simply because I'm in a research project. And what I think we're talking about here, at least, we're talking about things that I would have a right to under the contract if I were not a research subject. So the question is there a social policy value to say, well, you need to honor your contract. You can't simply exclude somebody simply because they're in a research project if being in that research project isn't driving your cost up in any way.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, is there any flip side to this coin? Specifically, if you're diagnosed with lymphoma, as an example, if there are no insurance barriers to a clinical trial, and maybe you have no idea in our state how this goes, but are people otherwise eligible and capable of becoming part of a clinical trial but are not being accepted by the institution doing the trial? I mean, is that a real phenomenon and one that needs to be addressed?
Yes, that's right. If the budget of a clinical trial is predicated upon the notion that people will come with payment for their routine care, there would be only one way to enter somebody in a clinical trial without bringing that payment, and that's if the institution had some independent funds available to apply, say, charity care funds to apply to that. I think it is clear that people, and I can't quantify this because all the clinical trials I've been involved in, people did come with money to pay for their routine care. I think there's probably lots of places where people are excluded if they can't pay for the routine elements of their care. They would be included.
But if there's no impediment that way, I'm diagnosed with disease X. Okay? Mm-hmm. My insurance is good. Maybe it's public insurance, but it's good private insurance, whatever the case may be, and it I'm eligible as far as my insurance is concerned. I go to institution Y, and have I met all the qualifications, or can I be qualified out even at that point?
Oh, absolutely. There are, usually in a clinical trial, relatively strict criteria. You might have to be less than 6'5". I mean, right. That's not the kind of criteria, but there,
so it's not the
there
all
are
hope
a set of criteria.
We would hope it would be, necessarily.
Well, I mean, for example, severe obesity can be a if it's a contributing factor to what you're trying to study in the hypertension study, we included people who were more than, I think, 2.5 times a median BMI. There are a variety of things. If I'm needle phobic, I might be excluded from a trial. And that, in some trials, we had run-ins where we really tried to draw blood from a person and see how they reacted, because if they were going to have their blood drawn, for example, in a children's study on the safety of low-fat foods, we had to have kids in it who were willing to have their blood drawn periodically. So there can be all kinds of exclusions that are related to the design of the trial. But other than that, there ought not be exclusions.
What's the matter?
Is another possible approach through the prompt pay laws to adjust that policy, that statute? Because it was testified that even if you have the coverage, that the issue, you know, the insurance company does the him and the ha and the denial and then the appeal, and because I don't know how many of these policies do cover routine services, maybe there's a way to kick them in the fanny that way to get them to go in the right direction to speed up the appeal.
Certainly, I'm not looking forward to kick anybody in the fanny, but I am, as you know, interested in the whole question of insurance company denials of coverage for a variety of reasons. And I think it would be very useful if we can find a way, depending on what comes out of the 395 process, to make sure that insurance companies aren't arbitrary and capricious in the denial of claims. My wife, as you know, ran a chiropractic office for a long time and claimed to me that there were some insurance companies that automatically rejected a claim the first time with the hope that they wouldn't be bothered with it being returned, and when you did return it, then they paid it. You may have had an experience like that once or twice in your own practice.
No.
But
Social Security disability.
Yeah, but I think there are various ways to address this, and I think we ought to explore them.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a sort of global issue. I think this part of the problem here, if I'm understanding it correctly, is just the lack of clarity around these policies and what they do and do not cover, what they do and do not exclude. And so the patient very often finds him or herself in the situation of having to try to navigate this kind of complex world of the insurance company's bureaucracy. And we heard that, talking to 10 different people and getting a slightly different answer and having to really advocate on behalf of him or herself. So even if it's the intention of the insurance policy not to exclude the cost that would otherwise, or the care that would otherwise be provided, and even if it's written that way, it seems like there may be a lot of value in putting something in the statute that just very clearly, very explicitly says to the public of Oregon, you are entitled to this set of care that would otherwise be included under your policy. And I do think it's a global issue. It got me thinking about the hearing we had earlier this week on options for young adults and what they may or may not have, but they may not know it, because we're dealing with such a complicated system.
Yeah, well, I would say, I suppose this is the right time to say, I wouldn't hold the institutions blameless either. And it seemed to me it would be very much in OHSU's best interest to have helped the patient get through. I mean, they have people in that university who spend a lot of time dealing with insurance companies, and it would seem to me there ought to be a way that the researchers could access that kind of help in the business office to try and find out whether, in fact, the patient does it or does not have insurance, rather than leave the poor researcher who's... Most researchers I know there are totally hopeless when it comes to the notion of how institutions get paid.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to, if I may, just a follow-up to that is even more directly the trials having direct contact with the insurance company to certify that, in fact, this is a, quote, legitimate trial. Here's our standards. This is the care that we provide. And so that the insurance companies are at least aware of these trials that are in, you know, taking place.
Well, for example, in cancer, there are clinical trial groups, SWOG, the Southwest Oncology Group, and NSABP, the National Association on the Breast Cancer Trial, and there are a variety of groups. In some instances, they do try and work with the large national companies to get agreements in advance about what's covered and what's not, and I think there are more of that. But it's harder with an NIH trial to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. We'll close the informational hearing on subjects in clinical trial and open an informational hearing on the question, should there be a place in the administrative arm of government that has oversight over the activities of health-related professional licensing boards in Oregon? And we have, what, at least one person testifying? No, I don't think. Do you want to speak on this one?
I'm not sure why.
He just wants to speak.
Yeah,
you want to start?
No.
The cameras
they're
are
talking.
On.
They're talking about another issue.
Right,
yes.
Board of Medical Examiners. So,
which we.
So you may want to just call Sue.
Okay. Sue, will you join us, please?
And the BME
won't be here till tomorrow to respond to this. So.
The BME won't be here tomorrow to deal with.
Right.
With Representative Gilliam.
Right.
And we'll either be here tomorrow or we won't be here tomorrow.
Correct. Right? Your call.
Did Claudia sneak up?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Susan Wilson. I am the director for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, which provides regulatory oversight for multiple group of health-related and other professions, incorporating a central agency model. The question you've posed is something that we've been involved in over the last nearly 10 years. This agency was established in 1999 by the Oregon Legislature as a standalone agency, and it was established to provide a fix for some of the smaller organizations, autonomous boards and advisory boards within other departments, and it was a calculated shift, correcting a century-old way of utilizing boards without utilizing their expertise as it relates to their practice standards, and providing a central agency to do the agency oversight and focus on the principles of the state of Oregon and how those relate to regulation and public protection. So I am prepared to answer questions, and I don't have any particular, you know, position one way or the other. I do want to say that the legislature has taken action over the last several biennia since 1999 to assist us in coordinating our statutes so they relate very well to the programs and boards that are under our jurisdiction. We currently have 57 members that are appointed by the governor that are representing 9 different professions, and 17 different professions, and they are serving on 9 respective boards.
Can we hold on just a moment?
Sure.
I want to deal with another issue first. Can you stand at ease just a second? The BME's.
Again, Chair Greenwood, members of the committee, Susan Wilson, Oregon Health Licensing Agency. I'm here to answer the questions as it relates to the model that was legislatively activated in 1999. And I think we represent a structure.
Who you represent in that?
Oregon Health Licensing.
No, I mean, which are the?
The boards the that boards. Are currently under our organization. Yes. I'll give you a sampling of those athletic trainers. Sex Offender Treatment Board was the most recent board that was sent to us during the last legislative session. It was a result of a task force. And Denture Technology, which is a long list, Board of Electrologists, Environmental Health Specialists, and Trainees, Hearing Aid Dealers, Midwifery, Respiratory Care Therapists, Body Piercing, which is a program. It's not a board.
Those others are boards?
Yes, those are boards.
Do they each have independent boards under your agency?
They have independent boards. Not independent in the sense of an autonomous independent board. Okay.
But there are individual boards.
Correct.
For respiratory therapy, say.
Correct.
And you have oversight over the whole set of them?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Some other questions? I have some more, but I usually like to wait.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Wilson, I'm trying to figure out how is the determination made who is within the OHLA and who isn't? Are there some boards over which you don't have oversight? And how is that decided?
Chair Green, like a representative. Originally, in 1999, it was decided based on a grouping of boards that needed oversight. Some of that determination was based on size, not having enough members to have an autonomous board. Some of that was based on being autonomous and needing an administrative home. So that was decided in 1999. Since that time, the legislature has either determined they wanted to regulate athletic trainers, for example. In the case of the sexual offender therapist board, that was the result of a task force, I think, headed up by the Attorney General's office, and there was a need for housing that particular board, and they came to us and asked how that might happen, and there was legislation to put them into this office.
During the very last session, huh?
Yes.
I have a question.
Thank you for being here. Am I correct that part of what the OHLA does is relicense members who are on in these various areas underneath your umbrella?
Chair Greenlick, representative, we license, we examine, and we monitor their qualifications. For example, if there is a statutory mandate in the case of a facility or business inspection to check if they are using high-level disinfectants and one-use needles, that would be a statutory relevance for my enforcement team to go out and conduct those inspections. We respond to complaints. We provide all the public relations piece. How do you get licensed? We have same-day licensing. We have, online renewals, all that kind of administrative piece when people are trying to get licensed once they've met the qualifications. We monitor that, and we test for those qualifications, or we recognize national testing institutions that have already tested, and they become licensed based on qualifications.
Okay. Can I follow up?
Yeah, please.
So how many did you say? I heard 9. I heard 17. I heard how many different groups do you do this for?
Mr. Chair, we have 17 actual professions. We also license two types of businesses, independent contractors and a facility for another group.
Okay. But can you tell us any reason why your responsibilities couldn't be expanded to do online relicensing of other health groups to consolidate those responsibilities?
Mr. Chair, and no, I can't tell you an answer to that as being, one way or the other. I'm here representing a model, and the legislature, of course, would make that determination.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my point is that as far as consolidation and consistency and utilization of resources, some of the larger boards have departments for relicensing, and they're doing exactly the same thing as currently being done for multiple health organizations, and there may be a value in asking why can't nurses be relicensed
in this room and not have to have FTEs in that department to do exactly what's being done here.
Let's take respiratory therapists, for example. How do you as an agency relate to the board and whatever licensing responsibility respiratory therapy has? Could you talk about that? Let's take that one as an example.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a good example. They are our consultants and our advisors as it relates to licensing and examinations and qualifiers.
They have a board?
They have a board. We meet with the board as it relates to the structure in order to carry out licensing, examinations, and compliance. For example, this is a good example, we just received a complaint that one of the practitioners was using morphine while they were providing service in a home setting. We don't have to meet...
The morphine on the cells or on their patient?
The practitioner was taking the morphine that was there for the patient.
The kind of sharing.
Sharing is a better point.
Unbeknownst to the patient, but here's the complaint. The complaint came into our office. I have a regulatory operations division, and they took action based on that complaint. They investigated, they called, they developed the file, and took action on the complaint in the sense that they became the investigators of that complaint and responded to the complainant and activated the Attorney General in the case that we needed the Attorney General as it related to the laws and rules. And then we met in an executive session with the board laying out the case, and they would advise us. That's an example.
It sounds like you act, let's take the nursing board. It sounds like you're acting as the executive director of that. So there are several boards with a single executive director and a single administrative staff. Is that
the Mr. Chair, there is. I believe there's more authority within the central agency than the example you gave with the nursing board. The board has more administrative authority over the day-to-day functions and how they go carry out those day-to-day functions. The example you used was the nursing board.
Nursing board.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I'm interested in this question, too, of exactly what authority, if any, the boards have under OHLA. You write, for instance, that the boards and councils do not have the authority, nor are they asked to oversee human resource functions.
That's right.
OLA's budget or other agency operations, planning, or performance. Mm-hmm. So what do the boards do, actually?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, the boards have a very important role, and that's the expertise that they bring based on their practice. Their practice as it relates to delivery under the statutory guidelines for safe public consumption of that and use of that licensee. We utilize the board in development of rules, in development of qualifications, in enforcement that is very detailed, and, for example, morphine use.
Will they ultimately vote on that case?
Yes, they would vote in executive session.
The discipline would go to the board. But you're serving as staff to the board in that disciplinary action?
Not in every case, but it depends on the way the statutes are written at the level, at the board level. Some are governance bodies and some are advisory totally. So we have a spectrum. However, the agency has the authority. This is different than the board of nursing, for example. The agency has the authority to react under its own motion and carry forward on a complaint without input from the board. If we get a consumer complaint, we react immediately. We don't have...
would the nursing...
Yes, and that could... And I did want to use that as an example.
But you would expect what would happen.
Yeah.
The executive or their staff would get a complaint, and they'd send an investigator out or not to deal with it. They wouldn't ask the board for authority.
Right.
But it's, if I may clarify, it's also the case that for some of these boards that you oversee, the board does not make the final decision
That's correct.
A complaint. They may recommend, meet, mm-hmm. review the work of the investigator, and recommend to you and your staff that the disciplinary action is taken or a license was revoked, but they don't have the power to do that. Now, it sounds like it depends on the board.
And, Mr. Chair, yes, that's true.
Okay.
You're correct.
Who do you report to?
I report to the director of the Department of Administrative Services. I was appointed by the governor.
Okay.
And I actually, at the time of my appointment, had Senate confirmation. They've changed that law a bit.
So you report to DAS. DAS has the...
That's correct.
This is interesting to us. Because we're trying to ask to what extent, as Representative Richardson, can some of the functions be centralized in a central administration and still deal with the autonomy of a board?
Mr. Chair, you know, it's really like relicensing. DAS is as good a place as any to kind of make sure that money gets used appropriately and that it is relicensing. Now, when you get to behavioral problems and potential loss of license with an advisory board, yes. Now it comes back to you. The advisory board can make a recommendation. Who has the authority to say that person may lose their license if the board doesn't? And what's their appeal process? You know, if they thought that they're being treated fairly, do they have due process?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. They have due process. We follow the Administrative Procedures Act. Absolutely. Each board is set up, and in fact, I brought the training manual for each of the councils and boards. We do a training session so they understand their role, and we view them as our partners. We have 57 members that work in tandem with our staff in making sure we aren't making the wrong decision and reacting in a manner that doesn't meet the...
That's right. The model is, I'm from DAS. I'm here to help you.
That's indirectly.
I think we're going to want to be talking to you a bit more, so I think we have a better understanding, because it is very interesting to us that you have all these boards, and these and not others. President Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have a quick question. How big is your staff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, 32
FTE.
About half the size of the nursing board.
Thank you very much for coming.
You're welcome.
I think we're going to be talking to you again.
Okay.
Let me close the information hearing. Yep. On open an informational hearing with an open subject.
Wasn't on the agenda, sir.
Okay. Sir Ross, will you join us? I'm sorry, what this is about for the group is... As Representative Gilliam and Ms. Ross had asked us to get a report on how the bill we passed on public disclosure of complaints to what's now the medical board was going, and we've ended up with a schedule problem where we asked the medical board to be here either tomorrow or Monday and asked Ms. Ross to be here today. So I really do apologize for that. Representative Gilliam, do you want to kick this thing off? And no singing, please.
And no, I won't. Unless you'll hum.
I'll hum.
It's Representative Vic Gilliam from District 18. And I appreciate the chance to be here. I'm sorry if I was part of the scheduling confusion. But don't be surprised if we're back tomorrow. Okay. But a scheduling conflict may... allow us to hear the testimony of the others and then have to scoot out of here, including Brenda Ross. So appreciate getting our part on now. I'll be very brief just to kind of remind you of where we were. And also, Representative Cannon was very concerned when he saw me here. He told me that there were no remonstrances, and I assured him that it's not why I'm here. You were kind enough to...
Probably no free remonstrance.
and there's no clock, so he can go this way.
We yield in advance.
Thank you.
You can see, Ms. Ross, we hold your representative in great esteem and affection.
Minimum high regard. As you all know, I was appointed to take Mac Sumner's place in this seat. And Mac Sumner... and Brenda Ross had begun to talk about this idea before. And it's been my pleasure to be sort of a backstop, but as helpful as all of you have been to me in my first year, I've learned more from her, I think, than all of you, because of her honesty, her tenacious way of tackling this, and her ability to get more co-sponsors on a bill than I think I ever could. And I think the main thing I want to underline here is that, in a sense, Mrs. Ross' part in this, in her story, which I think is worth reviewing here this morning, or this afternoon, was over. But on her own, she said, you know, that's fine, mine's been resolved, but there's still a problem, and I don't want somebody to have the same experience I had. And that's what was compelling to me. I am not a physician. I am not an expert in healthcare at all, but it seems to me, and it did, I felt like, to the committee last time, that there's something needs to be done, and that we need to reexamine the way that these that we reveal certain information. And I appreciate the fact that I hope that's not me. That you heard it, you heard our bill, and that you ask for this kind of a response and reexamination, that you're going to stick to that. I think the best thing for me to do would be to stop talking and let Brenda Ross talk, and maybe just remind you again of her situation as you prepare for your testimony tomorrow.
Chair Greenlake, representatives, thank you for hearing me again today. I would like to start out by saying that I, too, was involved in a clinical trial. It was a contact lens clinical trial. And when the doctors had told me that they could no longer help me with the lenses, I was able to get into a trial and work with people in making a new lens. And that lens has helped many people all over the United States now. And I am working again to try and be fitted with this lens again. But for 2 years, I was able to wear that lens. And if not for the clinical trial, I would have struggled with lenses that didn't work. And so, with that said, may I briefly go over what happened to me again, because it's been a year and some of you may not remember everything.
Yes, you may, but my guess is we remember pretty clearly.
Okay.
Yeah, it made a big impression on us, I can tell you that.
Thank
Please
you. Well, in 1999, I went in to have LASIK eye surgery, and the doctor ended up cutting way too deep. And through a series of events, he penetrated into the anterior chamber of my eye, and it left me needing a cornea transplant. I have not as yet had a transplant. I've been a chicken liver, and the doctors keep trying to talk me into one, and I keep battling with contact lenses. But prior to my surgery, I contacted the BME and asked if my doctor had complaints, and I was told that he didn't have any complaints. After my surgery, I learned of several people. I now know of four people who had filed complaints prior to my surgery, but none of those were revealed. So I thought that I might have misspoken, and I recontacted the BME to find out if I had misspoken and to find out if he did have complaints. Again, I was told, no, he didn't have complaints. I asked them at that time, how can you tell me that this doctor has no complaints when sitting in front of me, I have two copies of complaints, and I know of another complaint. And they said that they do not investigate any complaints unless they settle for over $100,000. That's where the flaw begins, because if a doctor or if a patient decides not to sue, which many don't, their complaints will not be heard. If you get gagged and you settle out of court, you cannot reveal to a doctor that you got over $100,000, or you can't reveal to the BME that you got over $100,000, and therefore your complaints are not looked into either. If the doctor goes to trial and...
This was before the law we passed in the last session. I think we made some changes in that, so these things are... No longer precisely true.
Okay. And I'm not aware of them. So, but anyway, so what I'm here today to say is, please do not allow these doctors to continue to practice without patients being able to find out this information. I know that last week another trial just finished up with the doctor that I had, and that patient will be filing a complaint also. And in 2005, I sat in on two trials against that doctor. So I know he's still damaging people. And I know that a lot of complaints are going out against him. When we were here last year, they said that this doctor had some of the most complaints out of the whole state of Oregon. I beg you to find out how many complaints he really does have. I think that that would be instrumental, because I think a lot of people are continuing to be injured that don't need to be injured. I would like to just briefly read you the mission statement of the BME, because I think that if the BME was really following the mission statement, people wouldn't still be getting hurt. And the mission statement says, the mission of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners is to protect the health, safety, and well-being of Oregon citizens by regulating the practice of medicine in a manner that promotes quality care. In addition to its licensing function, the board conducts investigations, imposes disciplinary action, and supports rehabilitation, education, and research to further its legislative mandate to protect the citizens of Oregon. And if they're there to protect us, why are so many people still getting injured by the same doctor over and over? I would like as a...
Didn't you have a bill that you were here in aid of?
Mm-hmm.
And we passed that bill, is that right?
No.
It
died.
I believe it got incorporated in Senate Bill 337, which was the Senator Bates bill.
Which passed.
Correct. But Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have right in front of me an analysis of what components of her bill got incorporated in 337, which is why we were going to have the BME here to walk us through that implementation and such tomorrow.
Yeah, I thought we had work to create. What was that? Yeah, I mean, we did work on an agreement with them where they would, in fact, post on their website these kinds of issues.
I was on the website yesterday, and the only complaint against this doctor is my complaint. There are no other complaints against this doctor.
And no action? My understanding also is the board has taken action against him as a result of those complaints.
The only action that's been taken against him is against my complaint.
Which has been part of the bill. Mr. Chair, and I am not contradicting you, but my understanding was... You considered our bill and set it aside. Now, if there was other language or another angle at this and said, now, basically, I mean paraphrasing, you said, this is an important issue, and I will ask you, board, about this in our next session. I did not know of an incorporation of similar language in a Senate bill.
We need to find out what, in fact, is the case here. And
Mr. Chair,
which bill did it go into?
I remember having lengthy discussions about how and when the information needed to be disclosed and what's put on the website. And
you were very much involved in that.
Right. What was the bill number?
I can't remember the bill.
Sandy, which bill did it go into?
Mm-hmm.
Which bill did it go into?
Into 337, which is an Oregon bill, ORS 30.265, 677205.
30.265.
Well, how many places?
Let's see what the bill says.
So what was the bill number?
337. Senate Bill 337.
Okay.
I apologize for our disarray on this issue.
But we can react.
Because I had thought that we, in fact, had passed that,
roll,
that bill.
And if you did act,
but we'll find out tomorrow.
Okay,
well.
Or a similar one. Still, the question would be, what's the implementation and how it's going in?
Bill number
is
3492. Which? 3492.
The bill we were working on?
That was the bill that was incorporated in some parts.
House Bill 3492?
From 2007.
Yeah. He remembers his dumb thing, Sam.
Oh, what bill was that?
3492.
Certain elements went into 337.
Okay. This is the enrolled bill.
It says, within 30 days after the date of an action taken in disposition of a claim, a reporter shall notify the appropriate board identified in subsection 2 of the disposition. A board that receives a report of a claim under this section shall publicly post the report on the board's website if the claim results in a judicial finding or admission of liability or a money judgment, award, or settlement that involves a payment to the claimant. The board may not publicly post information about claims that did not result in a judicial finding or admission of liability or money judgment, award, or settlement that involves a payment to the claimant, but shall make the information available to the public upon request. Now it comes back, remember?
Yeah, they'll
tell them that they're not going to necessarily.
But if there are any of those things, like a closed settlement or any of those things, that gets posted. But if none of those things happen, no settlement, no finding, then.
But complaints would be disclosed if you specifically ask, but they're not going to put all complaints just on the website. That's what they told us. The board shall remove from the board's website any record based on a recorded claim against a covered practitioner if the board does not receive another report of a claim against the practitioner within 4 years after the date reported under subsection 3C. So we did pass a law. The law says that when there is a settlement, it doesn't say over $100,000, any settlement or judgment, then it will be listed on the website. But if you want to know if there are complaints against the practitioner, they're not going to put all complaints on the website, but if you call and ask, they will respond to the question.
But the effective date would have been January 09, right? There wasn't an emergency clause.
January 08.
July 08.
January 08, I mean, yes. So, I mean,
so
it's only been enforced for about a month. It did.
Patrick remembers some of the bills, sir. If you want to come up.
Come on up, please.
Okay, you need to come and identify yourself.
I feel like
We're getting
a little lost here in this discussion.
Patrick Brotz, Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. This bill actually does affect the Board of Dentistry as well. There are some distinctions, and I know what this committee originally wanted, and that's not exactly how the bill came out. If you look at the definition of a claim, it must be filed in a court. If it is not filed in a court, it is not put on the website. So, for example, for the Board of Dentistry, we've been tracking since July 17th those claims that we get from malpractice companies. If they are filed in a court, we will be placing them onto our website. Now, we're in the process of updating that because it takes a little technical work to do that. Those that are not filed in court are not on that website, but we would have a way for people to know that there's something there, and then they could ask us that information, and we would then provide that information to us. And then, as you read, Representative Richardson, if you don't have anything in 4 years, it comes down. So in actuality, some of this bill made it less information to the public than more information to the public. In the past, all of the cases that are on the BMEs, or now the medical board's website, are there from the beginning on. Most of those will now disappear because there have been no actions against those particular doctors in the last 4 years as of July 17th. For our board, we have a lot less, obviously, for the dentistry board, and we've been working on that. We've been working with our IT consultant to get ready to put this up. But actually, there's only been a couple of them for the Board of Dentistry because they weren't filed in a court. So if, for example, this lady here went to the dentist and said, I want $10,000, and the dentist settled with her, that's never going to be reported, even though it may be reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank and other places, but it will never be on the website because it wasn't filed in a court. That's the big difference with this legislation, and I'm sure Director Haley from the Medical Board can tell you more. But, yeah, we actually had a meeting because we had to actually redo the malpractice form because this bill also took the Division of Consumer and Business Services out of the loop. They used to be the one that created the form that the insurance companies would send to us. We now created all of our own forms thanks to Kathleen and her staff. We sort of have a master form and just made it to each one of the boards that are affected by this bill. So I can answer questions.
How do you handle other claims that come to you from a patient that isn't filing a malpractice claim or some other?
If someone makes a complaint under Oregon law, that complaint is confidential until the board decides to seek disciplinary action. So, for example, you could have a dentist that could have 17 complaints. If the board never found any action, never took any action, those complaints are not public record. And that's an Oregon law. Not my law. It's a law that the legislature passed, I think, in 1989 or 88. I'm not positive. if the board takes action, then that information is public. And my understanding is one of the reasons that was done, I was not here obviously at that time, is it does have to do with frivolous complaints. I can tell you we get some complaints against dentists and dental hygienists that have absolutely nothing to do with their practice. We're obligated to investigate those complaints, and so they would be there for public consumption, yet they have nothing to do with the practice of dentistry. I mean, I have one recently that someone didn't like the fact the dentist owned the apartment building and raised the rent. So they filed a complaint with the Board of Dentistry.
Shouldn't make sense to me.
I just want to ask, Mr. Is it a few
Brotz.
Do you know where that particular section is codified, where in the statute
the
it is?
337? Or from the bill, you mean?
Well, the part that you were talking about that requires
about
the claim.
About the frivolous complaint.
Not the frivolous complaint. The part about what goes on the website and
the
what
claim,
doesn't.
I think Representative Richardson read it from whatever he was reading.
Well, I have the bill, but I just want to know where it ended up in the statute.
If you have the bill, I can probably show you. I can't tell you off the top of my
head. 742. Okay. I can find it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, it defines
where
the
it is. Okay.
Anyway, I mean, I'm sure Director Haley can tell you more from her aspect. From ours, we have been working with it, and we have been compiling since July 17th because that was the date it became effective. And they will go on our website as soon as we have our IT work done. But there haven't been that many. There have been a lot filed with us, but they weren't filed in court, so therefore they're not going to go on the website.
And they're not available if I call and ask you either?
If you call and ask, yes. We'll have another indication that says, please contact the board office regarding information, and then we will actually have them available. I mean, we don't get as many as the Board of Medical Examiners.
Well, no, I thought that was the agreement that we had, that things that weren't yet adjudicated or weren't.
But again, they still have to have, they have to have been filed in a court.
No, I was asking about things that weren't filed in court. Those 17 filed.
Mm-hmm.
If I call you, you won't tell me you have 17 that you're investigating.
No. I'm prevented by Oregon law from doing that.
Can you give us that statute so we know which one to change?
If you give me, I have to check on it. I can't off the top of my head. Yeah, I can get it. That's easy to get.
Mr. Chair, it was my understanding, and I'm relying on my memory, but it was my understanding that information about complaints, even though they weren't complaints filed with the court, was supposed to be available if you called. On the website went complaints that were filed with the court. That's the way
that was my understanding of what we ended up. Apparently we didn't end up that way.
Well, I don't know.
This has been your piece, hasn't it, Charlie?
I have 742 over here, Tom.
Oh, you want to join us?
Thank you,
Charlie. Is that after?
I have the research. Debates when it came to our
page. I don't know when the final version was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have the enrolled version here, but I don't
I
know.
What about that confidentiality piece? That's the one that interests me.
742-400. No, you're not. You can take that.
Mr. Chiefs, I'm really glad you're here again. This is the second day in a row, and I appreciate that. Third day in a row.
I'm just taking a second here. Chair Greenleaf, members of the committee, I think the really significant observation made by Mr. Brotz, Charlie Cheek, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, is the definition of claim. And as he explained, claim says clearly that it's a complaint filed with a court of appropriate jurisdiction, not with the regulatory agency.
No, I was looking for the other piece that Mr. Brotz said that. There are statutory confidentiality procedures that doesn't allow the board to reveal information about other kinds of claims.
I'd like to have a chance to review this before.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll be back tomorrow. Some of us at least will be back tomorrow and get some of this on record. Ms. Haley is going to join us. Perhaps you could join us as well.
It's your pleasure.
Will you be here tomorrow? Will you hang out here?
No,
that would be nice. We'll have a party. You'll be serving wine or something?
No, just chocolate. It's Friday.
Okay. We're going to find out what's going on. And if you can't make it tomorrow, you know how to find us on the on the web, you can listen in.
Oh, I can?
Yeah.
Yes. You can go on the web, and it's real time. These meetings are broadcast to whoever wants to tune in on the web.
I can be here for about the first 45 minutes of it. We'll
get started as close to 3 as we can. Probably right on time because we don't have 1 o'clock. And I'll be here, and it may be only me. We'll see. But if there are others in town, I join them. It's an informational hearing. We'll meet a quorum. You let all the other members know that I'll be here, and they're welcome to join me.
Okay. I'll just send out an agenda.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Brotz, for joining us. Mr. Cheeks, thank you very much. Representative Gilliam, thank you for stirring things up.
It's my pleasure.
It shows about the failings of memory about what actually happened.
Put in mind.
Okay. I will close this informational hearing. And I think, short of any other discussion, adjourn